Welcome to This Week in Debian, the podcast bringing you the latest interviews and news inside the Debian community, brought to you by frostbitemedia.org, the network bringing you your favorite GNU Linux podcasts. Hey, thanks for listening, but before we get into the interview, I want to mention a sponsor that we have this week. It's MobileTide. MobileTide is a website that gives you great deals on cell phones, and if you're looking for some Android deals right now, these guys have some awesome deals. If you want to get a Droid X, you can get one for $20 with a 2-year contract, or you can get the Droid Incredible for free with a 2-year contract. And the greatest deal is one that I unfortunately can't mention, but what I can say is the R2-D2 version of the Droid 2. Go to frostbitemedia.org/MobileTide. Go there, put the R2-D2 phone into your shopping cart, and you'll see the price. It's the cheapest one I've ever seen. And I just want to thank MobileTide for sponsoring us. And go check out frostbitemedia.org/MobileTide. Here's the interview.
We're going to talk about
Ordinarily, I tend to stick to slightly more technical presentations, like I've presented a couple times on the actual mechanics of packaging for Debian, which this presentation is not about. So I'll get into that. So a little less technical. So the idea is that maybe you have a favorite application, or you just discovered one, and you know you think, wow, wouldn't it be cool if I could instantly make this application available to 100 or thousands or tens of thousands of users. And there are a variety of different ways. You can always upload to SourceForge or CPAN or RubyWood or wherever, you know, depending on what your particular, what the purpose of your project is or whatever it is that you've discovered or written. But, you know, another way, of course, would be getting it included by a distribution. And there are fundamentally two kinds of packaging, your RPM-based distributions, so like your Red Hat, SUSE, so like that, and then there's dev-based packaging, which is like your Debian, Ubuntu, and those. There are some others, Slackware uses .tgz's, and there are others, Linux from scratch, just from the upstream tarball. But in terms of actual, structured packaging, those are the two big ones there. So the purpose of this talk really is about why get stuff packaged for Debian, and what are some of the things that you could do to help facilitate that, whether you are yourself an upstream developer, or you're just an interested user, or someone who is interested in becoming part of the Debian community, or something like that. So these are the particular things that I'm going to talk about. Jack, a little bit about me, kind of the why bother getting stuff packaged for Debian, and then a few things related to specific things that you can do or avoid in the actual software itself that help to facilitate the packaging process. So licensing or distribution, structuring software, the Debian release cycle, which is, there's a lot of misconceptions about that or misunderstanding that frustrate a lot of upstream developers. So I'll talk a little bit about that, and then handling upstream releases, getting folks to help out, documentation, and so forth. So this presentation, as I already said, is about facilitating the packaging of software for Debian. It is not a technical how-to on how to actually package for Debian. I've actually given a presentation that I created a few years ago. I've given it a couple times. And there's also the Debian New Maintainer Guide, which is just a good guide to read if you're interested in the actual technical, like these are the components of a Debian package, and these are the things that you put in the right files, and all the magic incantations to get an actual Debian package produced. So when this presentation is over, the objective or the takeaway that I have is that you would have a desire to go and actually get some new software package for Debian. And there's a variety of reasons to do that. So a little bit about me. I started using Debian in 2002. I was introduced to it through a graduate level software engineering class that I was taking. About a year later, I got actively involved in contributing to Debian. I can't remember precisely what the first like real contribution that I made to Debian. It might have been some bug reports. It might have been some documentation enhancement or a patch I sent in for some package or something like that. In mid-2005, I decided that I wanted to become like an official Debian developer, so I put myself into for the Debian new maintainer queue, and then about 6 months later, I decided that I really wanted to work for myself. I wanted to get, you know, basically paid to do my hobby, which is, I guess, everybody's dream. So I started my own company in order to help legitimize that. So that's basically what I do is freelance type work, and I do some software development, some architecting. Some of my customers or clients, I help them out with this exact issue of getting stuff packed in Debian format for deployment throughout their enterprise, things like that. And then I actually became an official Debian developer in March of 2007, and I currently maintain almost 40 packages in the Debian archive. I also sponsor uploads for several prospective Debian developers, folks for various stages of actually completing the process. So let me say this. I certainly will, you know, take questions at the end, but please feel free, you know, anytime, ask questions. Don't, you know, I'm hoping this is a more interactive kind of a talk, so people just kind of sit there and stare back at you and fall asleep. I have to wonder, is this you know, valuable? I want it to be valuable, so please do ask questions if you have. So, you know, the question here, you know, really, why bother? There's a variety of reasons. First of all, simplicity. I know a lot of folks have done RPM packages. Making Debian packages can be just as simple or complex. It's just different. So I would argue that it is, in fact, something that's relatively simple to do. It's very well documented. There's a utility called Dev Helper that actually automates a fair bit. Like nowadays, if you have an application that is a standard, like, you know, configure, make install incantation to get it installed, it's like literally a two-line Dev Helper script to turn that into a real bona fide Debian package. So, I mean, it used to be a lot tougher, but these days it's very, very simple. And there's a ton of documentation, and there are a lot of places to go for help for someone just getting started on this. The other aspect is exposure. So Debian has lots of users, and there's no, like, real official accounting of how many Debian users there are. Some people number it in the hundreds of thousands, others number it upwards of a million. Nobody knows really for sure, but it's a lot. And that's just Debian. So if you go online, and the link here on this on the chart here takes you to the Wikipedia article on Debian derivatives, or maybe Linux derivatives, I can't remember which. But the list, you know, where they're categorized, and Debian has over 100 derived distributions. And each one of those has its own user base. So it's a, you know, it's a geometric, you know, problem here in terms of figuring out how many users there are. But suffice it to say that there are a lot of users. So if you have an application and you want to get it exposed to a lot of users to get feedback or, you know, bug reports or suggestions on new features or whatever, this is a really good way to go. And another way is to potentially attract new contributors to your project. There are several projects to which I have contributed or am contributing upstream at various points. I think all of them, I actually first started using them as Debian packages. Like, it was something that was in Debian, I started using it, found something I didn't like, wanted to help out with, had an interest, just to stretch my interest, whatever it was, and then got involved upstream. And I know that for a lot of people, that is kind of their on-ramp into getting involved with upstream. So it provides a lot of good exposure for a project that way. So portability is another one. Debian officially supports 9 hardware architectures. So for those of you who remember back before 64-bit CPUs were very common, it was not at all unusual to find, you know, people had written stuff in C that was not 64-bit clean. And if all they had, you know, at home or whatever system they were working with was an x86 system, you know, those 64-bit bugs were going to kind of go, you know, would be left untreated. So one way that Debian helps is for packages that are architecture dependent in Debian to be included as part of the official Debian release, they need to support all of the architectures or all of the architectures where it makes sense. There are some packages that it simply doesn't make sense to support on all architectures, but the package should support as many architectures as possible. And if it fails to build on those architectures, it will actually hold up its propagation and testing later on in the stable. So for example, I have at home x86 and AMD 64 machines. I'm sure most folks have one or both of those. You know, how many folks have like an Alpha machine at home? How many folks also have a PA RISC machine and a PowerPC 64 and an S390 and a, you know, a Hitachi SuperH and a, I mean, you see where this is going, right? There's a lot of hardware architectures. Debian maintains an extensive network of build machines so that when you build a Debian package and it gets uploaded into the Debian archive, it actually gets farmed out to every single one of these, every single one of the architectures to a machine of the build network, and it gets built, and the logs of all of the, you know, the build execution get centralized so that you can go to your Debian, you know, quality assurance page for that package or that developer or whatever and look at all the build logs. So if the package fails to build up some architecture, you'll get to see. And so this has actually been a big help to certain projects, like for example the GCC project. This is how they help to identify a lot of the portability bugs is through the Debian build infrastructure. So they can really take advantage of that. And really any project that has architecture kind of components can do that. And then of course, ease of installation. If nowadays everybody uses some sort of package management system, probably except for Windows. So I mean, in reality, if you want to get apt installed, it can be apt-get install whatever, or yum install if you're on an RPM-based distro that uses yum, or if you like Synaptic, or you know whatever your favorite, whether it be Kremlin or GUI package manager. It's very, very simple to get installed. A lot simpler for a lot of people than downloading a tarball and then figuring out what are the dependencies that I have, and then trying to install something, you know, doing the configure fail because it couldn't find the Kerberos headers, and then I got the Kerberos headers installed without fail because it can't find the MySQL headers, and blah, blah, blah. So that the users don't have to go through all that. I mean, that may be fine for people who are actively developing with it or actively contributing to it and are always running the bleeding edge, but the vast majority of users of any particular project just want to get it installed and get going with it. Configuration is another place where Debian helps. There's a utility called DevCon that actually helps by having a uniform way for the package as it is installed to ask the user questions to set priorities, right? So you can set defaults and say this is a low priority question. So if the user has their priority set to only get asked high priority questions, it will just assume the default. But some packages have high priority or critical priority questions that you simply have to get answered as part of the installation of the package. The Debian package infrastructure helps to facilitate that. And then of course, upgrades. You make a new upstream release, it gets packaged, uploaded to Debian, and then voila, the next time the user updates, you know what they're doing, their apt-get upgrade command, and they get the latest version of the software. And then overall, I think it just helps to improve the software ecosystem in a variety of different ways. Getting packages put into Debian helps. You may say, well, I'm really not that interested in that. Well, if you write a library, for example, right, it's not just people are going to randomly say, well, I want to install this library. I mean, there are certainly folks who are going to want to develop with it, but then that allows other applications that are developed against that library to then be included in Debian and say, oh, I depend upon this library rather than having to embed code and things like that, or have to go out and manually download all the dependencies. So I don't think I need to extol the virtues of package management. I think, you know, pretty much everybody nowadays accepts that. But, you know, I submit to you that getting it into Debian is good for a variety of reasons. And most people would agree that Debian solved the packaging problem probably first. And it's, I would have to argue, having worked with both RPM-based, a lot of Red Hat Enterprise stuff, and then also with Debian, I would argue that Debian has the better solution as far as other distros. I'm not sure. I know there's a few others out there, but you know, definitely a good thing to do. So licensing and redistribution. So this is a big thing from the standpoint of Debian strives to have a completely free distribution. I know, you know, from the FSF perspective, they did come up with GNU/Sense because Debian was not completely, totally 100% free. Though I will say that with the release of Squeeze back in February, Debian 6.0, the kernel is now completely free of binary blobs. So that was a big step forward. Now there are still, Debian still has non-free repositories. Those are not considered part of the official distribution. They're not distributed on the official CD images. But I mean, let's face it, there are people out there who, you know, maybe they have a laptop issued to them by their company, and maybe they want to run Linux on it, and they don't really get a choice in the hardware. I mean, so there are, you know, practical issues that we have to deal with. Nonetheless, licensing is really important because copyright has kind of, as you know, Mad Dog kind of went over this as well in sort of the history of free software and all that. Copyright became an issue when we had automatic copyright assignment, and copyright left untouched prevents redistribution, right? So you have to license your work in such a way so as to permit redistribution. There are certain communities like the Perl community where this was never really a big deal. You know, within Perl, it's kind of assumed if you upload your Perl module to CPAN, your intent is that it be redistributable under the same terms as Perl. Okay, that's kind of okay, I guess, but that doesn't cut the legal mustard in some cases, so an actual explicit statement of license helps. So you want to make sure that you're using a license that's compatible with the Debian Free Software Guidelines. If you're familiar with the open source definition, Bruce Perens, who was previously a project leader, took the Debian Free Software Guidelines and basically made them a generic, you know, genericized them in such a way that they could be a more generic open source definition. But you know, the GPL, the BSD, the artistic user, the examples that Mad Dog used, they're all free software licenses. You want to make sure that you have an explicit license statement of license with the software. You want to make sure that all the components of the software are properly licensed. It really amazes me how often, you know, free software is great and it's a vibrant, you know, ecosystem. And the intent is that if you find something that somebody else has done, no sense reinventing the wheel, right? You take what they've done and you incorporate it, assuming that the licenses are compatible and all that, and you build upon what's been done before. However, we have to make sure that the licenses are compatible. I cannot just take a work that was licensed under the 4 clause BSD and incorporate it into mine as licensed under the GPL, because those two licenses are in fact not compatible. So you want to make sure that everything's properly licensed. You know, GitHub, there's actually a Debian legal mailing list that actually has several lawyers who post on it, and I believe legal counsel for SPI, Software in the Public Interest, which is the umbrella organization here in the US over Debian, that actually, you know, help to provide opinions. So when people are like, oh, I found this software and it's got this license, but it also includes components that are under this license and I'm not sure if this is okay, you can get help with that. And as I already said, you don't want to mix the components that are under the incompatible licenses. You don't want to assume that your distribution medium implies the license or the redistributability, like I said, the CPAN assumption, because really Perl got started, you know, really even before the FSF came into its own. So it's kind of, they have their own culture. You want to make sure that you are explicit about the license and the redistribution. And this is, you know, another one. If you are an upstream developer, I've seen this on several projects. Some upstream developers get upset when people want to package their software for Debian, because they feel that when the stuff gets packaged for Debian and uploaded into Debian and then distributed via the Debian Mirror archive, that they've somehow lost control of their software. And it always baffles me at people who write free software applications and release them under a free software license and then get openly hostile with people who want to package it for Debian. I mean, like, I somehow can't make sense of that, but it does happen. So if you are an upstream developer, please don't get hostile or upset with people that get bummed.
Kind of related to that, how likely is it that the software would be changed or patched when it gets included in Debian package, so it's not exactly what was upgraded?
So that depends, right, on a lot of things. I've got a little bit more on that later. It does happen. It does happen quite a bit. Debian has a very, very strict policy on the structure of packages. Some upstreams don't care so much about that, so the Debian, you know, the person who's packaging it for Debian will make changes to make it suitable to comply with the Debian policy. In all the packages that I'm involved in, I try to minimize the amount of diff that I carry as part of the Debian-specific packaging. I try to feed as much of that back upstream as I can. Some upstreams are welcoming of that. Others are like, well, that conflicts with other objectives that I have, so they don't accept that. Others say, you tweak my package for Debian, and I'm going to be, you know, really upset with you. So, but there are things that you can do to help facilitate that as an upstream developer, and there are ways that you can approach upstream as an interested packager to help, you know, kind of make that something that goes smoothly. So some things that you can do, so these are some of those things. So first of all, don't embed entire libraries or copies of other projects into yours. It's really surprising how many projects do that. It may be great from the perspective of, I want to make sure that when I do like an SVN checkout or you know, build out of my Git repository, I want to know that I've got, you know, version 1.4.7.3 of this particular library and version 2.9.4 of this other library and all that. But embedding the code, the copies of the code, makes it difficult because there's a security team that handles, you know, the security support for Debian, and every time there's yet another copy of some other code somewhere, you know, that's more code that they have to support, that they have to worry about vulnerabilities for. If the stuff gets out of date, it can be problematic. It can cause things like, if they're not installed properly, it can actually cause like the dynamic loader to like barf on itself, and it finds conflicting versions of the libraries in different places. I mean, so there's a variety of different issues that come as a result of that. So it's better not to do it at all. If you have to do it in your own subversion or your own Git repository for your own purposes, it's best not to release with that. And I understand the other reason some upstream do that is they want users to be able to, you know, I want to download the, you know, tarball for foo, and I want to make sure that the users that download it don't have to go out and download, you know, libvar and libthis and libthat and libtheotherthing. It's all there in the tarball. And that may be okay if that's something that you want to help facilitate users, but at the same time, it does make it more difficult for distributions that have extensive package archives, because that just introduces more duplication. So keep that in mind if that, you know, getting your software package for Debian is something that you may have an interest in. You know, if that's something you have, consider maybe making a different upstream tarball release that gets rid of all the embedded code copies. Or understand that when it gets packaged for Debian, those things may get removed from the upstream, you know, tarball to help comply with the Debian policy in that regard. So using this, you know, standard build infrastructure, if you're using C or C++, you know, the auto tools, configure, make install, you know, Java and, if you're doing Perl, module, build, you know, whatever language you happen to be building in or developing in, you know, the more of the standard infrastructure that you use, the easier that it makes it to package for Debian, because, as I mentioned, the dev, you know, low chance of that happening. But I've seen some really wild and crazy things that people try to do with their packaging, you know, with the actual build infrastructure. Anybody ever try to build OpenOffice from source? I've never actually met, the only person who I've met, I know for a fact have done it, is Rene Engelhardt, who actually maintains the Debian package for OpenOffice. He's like the actual only person I've ever met in person who actually can build OpenOffice from source. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, download the OpenOffice tarball from upstream. And the list of dependencies is like a mile long, and they've got all these kinds of weirdo tools, and you have to, it's truly amazing. So stay away from that sort of thing. Make your application FHS, that's File System Hierarchy Standard compliant. You know, if your application has data that it will modify, it belongs under /var. If it's serving up data, that directory from which the data is served should reside under /srd nowadays. You know, if you have a private library that nobody else is supposed to be linking against, it's only for your own, you know, it doesn't belong under user lib, it belongs under user lib, and then something that identifies your particular application, that way the dynamic loader doesn't, you know, get confused by finding it. I mean, so there are, you know, a lot of things, it's an extensive standard. You don't have to read the whole thing. It's not one of those things. I mean, it's like, I think this thing is written like the U.S. tax code. It's got a lot of stuff and all sorts of different, for the vast majority of things, you know, binaries go under user bin, libraries under user lib, variable data under /var. But, you know, a lot of it's common sense, but it, you know, helps to peruse through it and understand that, you know, you probably shouldn't be putting variable data, like if your application has, and this really baffles me. This happens a lot with web applications. PHP applications, I've seen this a lot with. It's nothing to do with PHP, it's the way the application is developed. But, you know, a lot of them will have like an online, what was the last one? I just did like a Drupal install for a client. So you like install Drupal, and then you go in and you have to like, you know, do all the settings and whatnot. It writes all the settings back out to a PHP file under user share, blah, 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 whatever. Well, what happens if I'm in an enterprise and user share is routed across the network? Well, what happens if I'm security conscious and I've got user mounted read only? Right? So you shouldn't be you know, changing stuff on your slash user from within the application. That is actually against the Hostage Priority Standard. So, and Debian enforces that, so the Debian packages of Drupal actually place all of those .php files that Drupal kind of messes around with under slash etc, because that's technical configuration, and then just symlinks them back from user share. So those are, that's actually a deviation from upstream in that case, that is to help comply with the Debian policy. So here's another one that if you use an auto tools based build infrastructure, that you want to make sure that, and this goes for others as well, but this is the, you know, best example that I can come up with. You want to make sure that you can build your application telling it that it's going to get installed under slash user, but then allow the actual install target to be somewhere else. And the example I gave here is you do a dot slash configure, then give it a prefix of slash user, then you do your make all. You know, this dest dir destdir option, you know, if you use like a standard auto tools, like if you call the house and all that, it'll be supported. But some folks cook up their own make files and leave this out. And what ends up happening is that whenever the package gets installed on the build host, it would then get installed into where it would really belong on the install host. So you can't assume that the host that I'm building on is the same one that I'm installing on. And for Debian, it's in fact always never the case. You want to make sure that you allow it to install some other place, and the build host, you know, typically will install somewhere under slash temp, because then it will descend into that subdirectory, package all that up into the Debian package, and then later when the user does have to install whatever, it'll drop the files all in the right place. But if you don't have this dest dir option, then the person who's packaging for Debian has to go through all these contortions to either intercept all these things going into the file system or actually patch the build infrastructure and support it. So this is something that you can do to help. I'm not sure, like for Ant or for the others, how that works. I know for Perl, if you use like the standard like PHT Make Maker or Module Build, there are options that support that actually support this. This is another big problem. So names, how many of you all like have ever had a problem with a, how many of y'all have ever seen libraries that don't bother with a so name? I don't even know that so name stuff. And they're a shared library. That's really not good. So name was invented for a reason. It stands for shared object name. It's what allows you to have different versions of different libraries on that allow you to have, you know, some application depends on, you know, libssl 0.9.6 and a new version of libssl 0.9.8. If you don't have the versioning in there, things get all kinds of wacky. And then every time you change a library, everything that depends on it has to be completely rebuilt because you're replacing it as opposed to potentially installing a new version and allowing the old version to coincide or to, you know, live alongside it. There's a fantastic how-to that's linked here. And incidentally, my slides are up on my website. I'll have the URL again for those who want it, or I'm thinking about this for anyone. But there's a fantastic how-to that's written specifically called the Debian Library Packaging Guide that talks a lot about managing so many. It's something that's easy to do. It's also easy to get wrong. And what's really amazing is how many, like I packaged TDB, the Freddy Building Blocks library, for one of my clients. Freddy Building Blocks is an Intel product. Okay, Intel writes their own compiler. It's called ICC, the Intel C compiler. When I first packaged TDB a few years ago, it didn't use Sonin. And I'm like, really, a product from a company that builds an actual C and C++ compiler and doesn't have a so name? I mean, it was really quite amazing, but it happened. So you want to make sure you do that. Packages, libraries without a so name, flat out will not get into Debian. So if you're building a library that's, you know, that's a C or C++ library, you need something like that. There are potential hangups here. If you use STL, the standard template library, and C++ library, it makes managing the so name more challenging, but not impossible. Okay, if you have software that phones home to check for updates, Mozilla, anyone? Make it easy to disable that feature, right? In Debian, the users are going to get their updates, you know, through the Debian infrastructure. So there's really no need for your application to phone home back to the mothership to check if there's updates available. The Debian packager will take care of that, and when they become available, it will automatically notify them and the updates will get installed and all that. So that's just a small one. There's a whole lot more. There's a Debian Mentors mailing list. There's other mailing lists, the Debian Developers mailing list, where you can ask for help on things that you might want to, if you have questions, or things you may want to do to actually help make your package more suitable for Debian. again, everything you can do to make it easier. And granted, you know, making stuff more suitable for debugging also makes it more suitable for RPM packaging, for other distros. I mean, so this is not just a, I'm going to expend this effort, and it's only going to be valuable if I have stuff I use package for Debian. It helps make the software better. All these things, these Debian policy things, there's a good reason for it. Debian has like 30-something thousand packages in it now. They've had a lot of breakage over the years. They've figured out a lot of problems. So you're taking advantage of a tremendous amount of knowledge that has come about as a result of fixing problems that have been encountered in the distribution. So a little bit about the Debian release cycle. There's a release every 18 to 24 months. The current squeeze is the current stable is version 6.0 released this past February 6th. Once a stable release is made, only security fixes are possible, generally. I mean, there are other very serious bugs that can be fixed, but it's not like, oh, I meant to allow this option for the user to tweak this setting. Those kind of things you're not going to get into a stable release. New packages enter Debian through the unstable distribution following a transition to no release critical bugs. They will then transition to the testing distribution, and then several months prior to release, testing will be frozen to minimize the number of changes only to those that are fixing these serious bugs and whatnot, and then after some period of time, a release will be declared, and that testing distribution becomes stable, and the process happens all over again. This is important if you develop a very large or very complex piece of software, like, say, KDE or GNOME. You know, Debian, the release was February 6th. The freeze started last August. In fact, during DevConf, they announced the freeze. So the freeze period was 6 months. So the, you know, version of GNOME, and GNOME doesn't, it's not like one of those things where like it gets released on Monday and like by Wednesday afternoon it's in Debian. There's a lot, that's actually one that has a very large diff from upstream. There's a tremendous amount of work that goes into making it suitable for Debian, and it takes months. So it's not like the, if like GNOME had made a release like in January, it's not like that was ever gonna make it. Even if they made a release back in July, it's probably like that was not gonna make it. So, you know, if Debian is a significant chunk of your user base, you want to be aware, kind of keep track of what the release cycle looks like. As a freeze is imminent, you want to, if you're going to make any disruptive changes, you're going to want to do that ahead of the freeze to allow the freeze process, you know, the freeze period of time to help you work those things out. Again, if Debian is a significant part of your user base. If you don't care so much about that, or if your user base is very small, or if it's a very simple package, probably not, so, not something you need to worry about specifically.
Is there a limit to the disruption you may cause before a freeze?
Well, I mean, the release team gets upset with, like, if you do, like, a major library transition without, like, notifying them. There have been, I mean, they call it unstable for a reason, but they like to keep it at least working most of the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you want to coordinate with, you know, with the release team on doing library, you know, transitions. Anything that you think may result in a lot of other packages having to be rebuilt to support changes in your package makes, mostly libraries, but it does happen with other packages sometimes. We'll want to be coordinated with the release team. So, for new upstream releases, as I mentioned before, you know, under licensing and redistribution, you want to make sure that that stuff is accurate, up to date. Copyright, if you pull in files from other projects, you want to make sure that you preserve the copyrights associated with those, the copyright notices at the top. If you find something cool that somebody else did that doesn't have copyright in it, email them. Say, hey, would you mind, you know, adding a statement of copyright, either a new release or, you know, drop an email telling me this is what this is and I can add it in. You know, most folks are pretty receptive to that. If it's something, you know, if somebody wrote up a 200-line Perl script and was, like, never really going to use it or anything, just post it on their website or whatever, and you find, hey, that's really cool, I'll include that in my project. You know, you want to make sure that you are doing the due diligence and getting the copyright statement and the statement of license and all that in there to help, you know, preserve the integrity of the archive. New upstream releases kind of, when a new package is introduced into Debian, brand new, it goes through the new queue and it's actually reviewed by the FTP masters, and they go through it with a fine-tuned comb. New upstream releases don't have that because it's already in Debian, so you want to make sure if you're packaging stuff for Debian, you carefully vet the upstream releases, and if you are an upstream developer, make sure that if you make significant changes, you're adding in new components or things like that, and you're keeping this information up to date. Release, you know, with a standard tarball name. It really amazes me how many people, and I'm not going to name any specific project, but there are some projects that literally every release is called foo.tgz. And they just say, here on the web page, it's like, oh, I released version, you know, 2.4 today. Well, that's great. You know, there's something called the Debian External Health Status that is actually a, you know, service that Debian runs that will go out, and there's a watch file that you put into your package. Tell it where to find the upstream, and it can go and check the version numbers and tell you when there's a new version so that we can have a lot of packages or you don't actively follow upstream development, you can find that stuff out. these projects that do that, where they send everything to the mailing list and then they just post it like in a directory foo.ttz, you know, you have no way to know unless a human being is actually following. So these kind of things help providing all of the tarballs in a listable directory on an HTTP or FTP server is the best. We're using a well-known project hosting service, cpanag, SourceForge, Berlioz, GitHub, Google Code, any of those is also okay because Debian External Health Status knows how to check against those. But you want to make sure that you actually version your upstream releases. It's really surprising that some projects don't. Some projects, maybe they do their own, maybe not policy compliant, they do their own Debian packaging, just kind of quick and dirty for their own purposes. And that involves introducing a Debian directory to the upstream release. Don't include that in the upstream release. I mean, maybe having a version control that actually makes it harder for the Debian package to package. They have to remove it prior to packaging so they can introduce the quote-unquote official Debian package stuff into there. Don't ship BCS directories when it doesn't make sense. How many people download like this is, you know, release 1.4 tarball of something and you untar it and there's like a bunch of CPS or SVN directories in there. Okay, forget it makes sense because every directory can in fact be a complete Git repository. SVN, CVS, not so much. So if it doesn't make sense, don't ship it. There's a reason why CVS and SVN have an export command in addition to a checkout key. You know, please learn about it. Make security updates available for previous stable releases. So this is one that gets to be a little bit frustrating. Certain projects like Mozilla, their policy is development always moves forward. They do not really do branch development the same way that, you know, they don't say, oh, like for those of you who remember, you know, previously Linux kernel prior to 2.6, you know, you had the development branch and then you had like the stable branch. And the stable fixes were going to there. It actually made it relatively easy to get security fixes into Debian because, you know, you just do a diff and okay, there's my security fix, and I'm gonna have to do some tweaking and massaging to get it into Debian. No big deal. Other projects like Mozilla, they lump it all together. They have like one branch of development. So, you know, and I mean, you know, and not to pay on Mozilla, but they do have a fair bit, you know, fair number of security vulnerabilities get announced against them relatively frequently. It makes it hard. So Debian actually has made a special exception for Mozilla. I guess probably wasn't the best example to use. They actually made a special exception where they don't do security backports for Mozilla. When there's a security vulnerability for Mozilla, they just take the newest version, and even into Debian stable, they'll just upload the newest version because getting the security support from Mozilla in that way isn't helpful. But, you know, projects like Postgres, MySQL, stuff like that, where they have multiple branches of development going on, getting those security updates to some of those older branches is extremely helpful for the Debian stable community. All right, so that's probably the most technical part of the presentation, some of the things that you can do to help facilitate the actual packaging. Now you may say, that's all well and good, but I don't really want to package this stuff for Debian myself. How do I get somebody else to do this for me? Right, that may be your question. So the first thing is file a request for package mod. So there are people all over the world who, believe it or not, are actually interested in becoming Debian developers. And part of becoming a Debian developer is maintaining Debian packages. So these folks actually actively seek. And now some folks come into it with their own software that is written or their own software that they're using that somebody else wrote that maybe is already packaged for Debian, and that's what they package. Other people are just like, look, I want to become a Debian developer, I need to maintain some packages, I'm just looking for stuff to maintain in Debian. And there are people who actually go through and look for these requests for package bugs and actually take them up and say, okay, I'll package this one up, and they grab the software, the source code, package it up, and voila, package goes into Debian. Because somebody who's interested in becoming a Debian developer found a request for package bug for somebody who was interested in getting something packaged for Debian, but not interested enough due to maybe type constraints or whatever to actually package it themselves. There are a variety of teams in Debian. So this is something that over the last few years has really taken off in Debian. It used to be a lot of individual effort. Now there's a lot of team effort. Specific application frameworks like kernel and GNOME, specific languages like Java, Perl, Python, or general categories of software. Games, GIS software, scientific, stuff like that. So you can check with one of those teams and see if, you know, if you develop a Perl module, check with Debian's Perl team. They would probably be willing to just take your module and add it to the team repository and maintain it for you in Debian if you are not so inclined to do so individually. Other things that you can do, make an announcement on your project, webpage, blog, you know, whatever, basically saying, hey, I would like to get my software put in Debian, I need some help, is anybody willing to help? You know, it's amazing just asking for help, how much that, you know, how far that will take. Or you can hire someone to do the work for you. I would ask you to hire me. That's actually one of the things that I do. Several of my clients that actually have clusters and develop their own software or use software that it doesn't have quite the same user level of interest as a lot of other software, so it wasn't already packaged for Debian. Threading building blocks is one example I did for one of my clients. They do a lot of cluster computing applications. They were using it straight from upstream for Intel, and they said, look, we've got all these cluster machines. We want to help make the deployment process quicker, easier, less prone to breakage. Could you package this up for Debian for us? I said, sure thing. Took a couple of days, did it, voila. So now a new upstream comes out. In fact, I just did one a couple days ago. The upstream release came out for threading building blocks. It took me 1 hour to update the package for the new upstream release. They really like that because, I have a reasonable hourly rate, and they're like, oh, cool, an upstream release, 1 hour's worth of work for the guy, and they can just drop it into their internal repository, and voila, it makes it out to all of the machines on all of their clusters without break. So that's, that's something that, again, a reason why you may want to do it, but there are a lot of folks, there's a Debian Consultants webpage, that there are lots of folks out there that this is what they do for a hobby, and then also what people pay them to do. Documentation is another good one. So, Mad Dog's point about if you buy software, people expect good documentation, notwithstanding, nowadays, certain projects like WX Widgets, PostgreSQL, have set the bar really high on documentation. So a lot of people actually expect documentation, even in free software projects. I think that personally, to me, that's a good thing. That means that we've come a long way. Yet there are still a lot of projects that are like, I'm not going to bother with that. If you're developing a library, use Doxygen, Doc++, Java Doc, whatever makes sense, Perl Doc, whatever makes sense for your project. But if you are if you're deviating from anything, of your languages like standard build conventions, please document that. Any additional manual actions you have to take. If you are, writing a web application and part of the setup is, installing a database, like some tables for this thing to work against. That's not something you can always script as part of the install of your project, right, or your software, because, well, what if the database server resides on a different host? What if the person installing this application doesn't have admin access to the database? So you might write a separate script for that. You might write some separate instructions or steps to take. Documenting that stuff is really important to helping the person who's doing the packaging for Debian understand, helping that person understand what they need to do, how they need to package it, and what additional things they need to document. Include man pages or info pages for executables, config files, there are 9 sections under man. Learn about them, use them. It's really amazing how many projects the only documentation they have is the HTML up on the web page. Write your stuff in DocBook, write it in XML, write it in whatever, in ROF or anything like that, and you can actually generate all of those formats from it, including manual pages to include as part of your release tarball. And include detailed change logs and release notes. I'm really baffled a lot of times when I see a new upstream release and the diff from the previous upstream release is 30,000 lines and there's one entry of a change log. Really? No. Not everybody follows the upstream development day by day and follows every commit into the upstream BCS. So the detailed change logs help provide the Debian packager who may not be intimately involved with the upstream development some insight into what's going on.
As a developer, I would suggest, number one, you use the source control system. Number two, you check in to put meaningful comments on it, because it'll be changed, and then the change log is there automatically for you.
That's very
true. It's a painless way to generate the status.
Just good commit messages right there, and then all you have to do is dump the logs from this version to that version, of whatever makes up the new stuff in your upstream release, trim out the chaff, and voila, your change log is already built for you. So that's a very, very, very useful thing. So on the other side of it, you may be interested in helping out. So what can you do? I'm going to try to speed this up because I want to make sure the next guy has enough time. On the Debian side, helping out, there's the WNPP, work eating and prospective packages. That's where the request for package bugs get filed. Also, orphan packages. So that may be something else, right? There may be a package that's in Debian. The previous maintainer lost interest, moved on to a different job, whatever it is, for whatever reason, they decided they're not going to maintain it in Debian anymore, they orphaned the package, and it's been 2 years since the package got updated in Debian, there's been like 5 directory releases. So, you know, this is a good place to go to find out what packages are maybe in need of some help if you just kind of want to pitch in there. ITPs, that's somebody expresses an intent to package a particular piece of software. Those get stale, people never follow through on them or whatever. Join one of the teams that I talked about before. Another thing you can do, if you have a project that's big upstream, like if you go look, for example, the Linux kernel package in Debian, I forget how many open bugs they have, but it's like, say, I want to say somewhere in the range of 1,000 open bugs just in the Debian BTS. A lot of those get, you know, get relayed upstream, but you know, helping to triage bugs, reproduce them, solve them, stuff like that, that helps out as well. Again, packaging the software yourself. There's mentor.debian.net. You can maintain a Debian package and never become an official Debian developer with actual upload privileges to the Debian archive. If you don't want to go through all of that, you know, if you're not interested in contributing to that level, you just have like your one pet package that you want to maintain. You can do that, and through the mentors site, you can actually find qualified official Debian developers who can, you know, are willing to review your package for quality, and then they will sign the package upload with their key and upload the package on your behalf. So you do the work, they do the upload for you. That's another good way if you're interested in going through all of that stuff. Or you can just take the plunge, become an official Debian developer. That's what I did. I'm very happy ever since. On the upstream side, you know, involve the maintainer of the Debian package of your software or prospective maintainer of your software. Shorewall is one of the ones in which I'm more active. The author, Tom Estep, I've become good friends with him over the years. He and I dialogue almost on a daily basis. I mean, I kind of keep track of what's going on. He works for HP, and the project that he works on in his day job is a very you know, monolithic, slow-moving thing. So, you know, he doesn't want to replicate, you know, his work in his free time, so he makes Shorewall very agile. There's a release like every single month. Like literally every 4 weeks there's a new upstream release because he likes to keep it fresh. So I stay very closely involved with him on what's going on, so that when the structure of the package changes, when things like that happen, you know, I'm up to speed on what's going on. If you have a large or complex package like MySQL, Postgres, Apache, Linux kernel, anything like that, you want to make sure that you know, that by reaching out to the person packaging for Debian and keeping them involved helps to ensure the quality of the package in Debian itself. You know, acknowledge security issues in a timely manner, release fixes in a timely manner. As I was talking about, accept patches from the Debian, you know, maintainer. Sometimes things need to get tweaked to, you know, comply with Debian policy. You want to make sure that you, you know, as a Debian packager, Debian maintainer, feed those back up to upstream. As upstream, if it makes sense at all possible, accept those patches because it helps reduce the amount of diff that's carried into the distribution. And then beyond Debian. So all this talk about talking Debian, this, Debian, that, Debian, the other thing. Okay, I know a lot of people out there use Ubuntu. That's great. If you get your package into Debian first, it will, through the natural course of time, make its way into Ubuntu and into many of the other, you know, distros. Now, some of the derivative distributions take the approach of anything that's in Debian is in the derivative. Others take the approach of, you know, we're filling a particular niche, so we're only going to take a select subset of packages because, let's face it, not everybody has 50 bazillion terabytes to run in your archive for like 9 different hardware architectures on 30,000 different packages. So for, I'll take the example of Ubuntu specifically. You know, you upload a package to Ubuntu, and I forget, there's usually some delay, but after some number of weeks or months, software automatically gets synced periodically down to Ubuntu from Debian. If you upload something to Debian and you want it in there next week in Ubuntu, you can actually put in a manual sync request, and a, you know, an Ubuntu you know, archive maintainer will actually go pull the package into Ubuntu, you know, ahead of the normal, you know, sync schedule and get it in there. So you can, you know, if you have a lot of Ubuntu users, you know, that's one way, or whatever your favorite Debian derived distro is. So there's stuff that you can do there. As I mentioned, you know, at the beginning, Debian has lots and lots of users. The derivatives are many, they're plentiful, and each one of them has their own installed user base. So there are a lot of potential user base out there just in that. So there are lots of reasons, at least in my mind, and I will go ahead and say I am biased. I think there's lots of reasons to get software package for Debian. I think Debian's a great distro. But again, there's Ubuntu, there's other derivatives. And overall, I think it helps to improve the software itself. I think it helps to improve the software individually as a project, and I think it helps to improve free software in general just because of introducing, you know, these these things that have been over the years discovered, you know, as quality, you know, things, potential quality issues, hang up problems, whatever. If we fix those before they become problems, it just makes the general software ecosystem better. You know, whether you're an interested user, whether you're yourself an upstream developer, you know, just have at it. Are there any other questions at this point? Yes, sir.
Oh, I was reading the other day, Linux standard base chose RPM standard.
Yep.
Are you negotiating with them? Because, I mean, the thing is, I remember back in the Harry Day's RPM of all, dependency hell.
Right. Okay, so there's a bit of a misconception there, right? RPM is a package format. Just like .deb itself is a package format. Okay, so a lot of people think RPM compared to apt. Okay, they're on two different levels, right? RPM is a package format, apt is a package manager. So the comparison that you want to make is Yum or another appropriate, you know, RPM-based package manager. There's actually a port of apt to the R for, you know, apt for the RPM package format. And in those cases, you know, dependency resolution is just fine. So there really would not be much difference if Linux standard base had chosen the .deb format over the .rpm format. That's just this literal internal structure of how the archive of one individual package is actually structured, including locations of files and things like that. Package management is one level above that, and that's where the dependency resolution comes in and stuff like that. So, I mean, you know, if you want to be LSB compliant, you have to support RPM. Debian supports RPM, and Debian is LSB compliant. You can there's that RPM package in Debian, you can install it, you can install RPMs in your Debian system. There's really no issue there. So, I mean, it's kind of a non-issue.
What happens with dependency resolution when you have both devs and RPMs?
The recommended way to go is to not mix the two. Like I said, it's possible. There's a package in Debian called Alien that you can say Alien, you know, foo.rpm, and it will actually translate it into a .deb file. It does not make a policy compliant. It's not going to fix like policy problems in the RPM in terms of like comply with Debian policy, but it will make a functionally installable .deb package. Several years back, I was doing some experimenting with ICC, the Intel C compiler. They released an RPM. I fed it through Alien, turned it into some .deb. I mean, they'll install under /op, which is not a, you know, place that you can legally install software and still be compliant with Debian policy. But I was able to install them with, you know, dpackage minus I *.deb. And dpackage knew about them, knew where they were. I was able to uninstall and get all the cron out of the system when I was done with it. So that there are a couple different ways to do that. Yes.
There's been a time or two where I've tried to install a package that didn't have all the dependencies met perfectly.
Yep.
And Debian apt-get offered like suboptimal solutions with like a rating system. Can you explain that a little bit?
Okay, so there's it's actually a relatively complex answer, and I'd be happy to talk more afterwards, but you know, the Reader's Digest version is Debian has a facility called Provides. So like, for example, you have Send Mail and Courier and Postfix, and all of them provide mail transport agent, MTA, right? So you can have a package that you say, well, I don't care if the user installs Courier or Postfix or MTA, like if you're installing like Open Groupware, right? I just need an MTA on the system, right? It doesn't matter which one. Depending on what particular package you have installed at the moment and what particular things the other package needs, resolving the dependency conflict could involve removing some software to install other software. It could involve keeping the software you have plus installing additional. So depending on, you know, and it's impossible for me to say without knowing exactly like what the issue was, but it can figure out multiple paths to get you to where like whatever action you stated for apt-get to do would actually be accomplished. It seems sometimes in like major upgrades, like you do like a dist upgrade, like for a new stable release,
that's what I saw. Where
you could actually have literally thousands of packages. It wants to remove them because of like some weirdo conflict. For new Debian releases, those things are hopefully tested out well ahead of time. And I know for Squeeze, where if you see like where it says like before you start, do like apt-get install this, apt-get remove that. That's to help prevent those kinds of issues from happening. It does happen, though, in unstable stuff from time to time. Your transients is like part of library transitions and stuff like that. And all it's telling you is there's more than one way to get to where you want to be, you know, kind of which way you want to go.
Thanks.
I saw another.
Yeah.
Basically, I tried to install probably 4 or 5 years ago, and I gave up on the installation. It was really hard. How difficult is it now?
So my first Debian install was Debian Woody, and I literally had to have a friend of mine who was an expert on Debian. Like, he had to like hold my hand through the whole thing, and he had to walk me through step by step. The most recent, it's been getting better for years. SARS was a quantum leap compared to, huge difference compared to Woody. Leti was much better. Squeeze is absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's like you put it in there, you know, and you, I mean, the CD, USB, I mean, whatever, you can install it off any medium you want off the network. And I think you have to answer, like, the questions that you have to answer are, like, what's your time zone? What language do you want your default localization to? What do you want to set as the root password? And everything else is pretty much can be done automatically. I mean, partitioning used to be particularly complicated. You can do it. It's a piece of cake.
Yeah, not anymore.
Different derivatives and all that kind of stuff. They had the only way so far is kind of fostering one set of install.
So I guess what's the question there?
Yeah, I was kind of wondering. No, what the fuck that came to my mind is an example that I came across. I recently had installed Linux Mint for a few people. But sort of kind of knocked it over a little bit once I installed it. Is that now? I understand that the Mint is supposed to, you know, for those who are used to Windows, you know, so easy transition.
Sure.
When I installed it, what was not a default was the switcher. You know, you have the default, you know, 4 virtual desktops.
Oh, right.
Switcher.
Right. Yeah.
And they didn't do it, and I was so scratched my head. I know you want to cater to the Windows users, but to just show a little bit of the power of the Linux has, why would you not, have this switcher on as the default?
Okay, so I'll use an example. There's a lot of people, with KDE, eternal battle between I'm not going to say which is which. But, okay, GNOME has significantly fewer options available to the user than KDE. Through the interface. And if you want to go into gconf, through the command line, GNOME is just as customizable as KDE. In KDE, it's like you can bring it up in the GUI, and it's like page after page after page after page of options. Some people say that, well, that would be off-putting to a user coming from Windows that's used to, like, Bill Gates decides, this is how your configuration is going to be, and we'll be into you if you decide to deviate from them. Now, certainly, people, power users can go out there and get these, different add-ons and whatnot for Windows. Granted, we don't have to go out and get external applications to help us configure, our favorite Linux distro more effectively, but some of these distros where they are catering to that niche market or specifically targeting, in this case, Windows, there have been lots of distros over the years. Xandros, Lindos, which later became Linspire, literally the ones coming off the top of my head, but there have been others that specifically targeted Windows users. They use themes that look very much like Windows for the desktop environment. They take away a lot of the options because they want to help the user feel comfortable. It's kind of like the same thing. It's like if, when I first moved from Florida to Ohio, I was used to going to the store, and I would find, certain things at the grocery store, and then I go to the store, Ohio, and it's like they don't have the same products, so it's a little uncomfortable, right? I'm like, well, I don't know which one to pick because, I used to use such and such a brand of this thing, and they don't have that here. All they have these three, but I don't know which one of these three to use. So the idea is that it's about facilitating the comfort level. Does that make sense? So it's not that it's not there. You know that it's there. You're a power user. Now, if you're doing this install for somebody else, you may know better if that user is of the type of person who might be more amenable to learning more about the power of Linux. Maybe you can say, hey, maybe you want to learn about this feature. But for somebody who just randomly grabs,
in response to this gentleman's question statement, in having installed several versions, be it Ubuntu or Mint or Peppermint, so on and so forth. I found that I personally, when I customize these machines for folks, I spend probably more time in writing a very customized help file that appears right on the desktop for that person to kind of bring them up to speed. And you have to, when you do that, sometimes you, you get a little bit more knowledge about the customer than others, but you try to incorporate all that. And it's that is more difficult than it is to install this an operating system, even a dual boot or whatever. So that's that would be my suggestion on how to handle the situation. And it's not easy.
So I think I've probably taken way too much time from the next presenter, so I should probably. But if there are any more questions, afterwards, I'll be glad to answer them if you have them. But Jonathan, thanks for or I guess that's all you want to make it out, right?
Thank you for listening to This Week in Debian. If you know someone or you yourself are in the Debian community, please get a hold of us. We can interview you. If you'd like to get a hold of us, our email address is feedback@frostbitemedia.org. Again, that email address is feedback@frostbitemedia.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.